A lot of chatter going on, a lot of excitement. I'm assuming that that's directed towards our summer picnic that will be occurring in a matter of maybe 30, 35 minutes, so bear with me. I personally am excited because I happen to be a baseball alum of one of the teams that will be competing for the national championship in the College World Series. That's Coastal Carolina University. I'm really excited about that. I don't care if you're a baseball fan or not, you should become one. Anyways, I'm really, really excited about that. It's a big deal for the school, big deal for the program, big deal for the people that have been a part of that program. At any rate, we're going to stop talking baseball and start talking round 13 of our Colossians series, because that's where we are. And in a sense, we'll be picking up where we left off last week, in that we're still in the family context, we're still in the family constellation and talking about relationships inside of the family. And specifically, we'll be shifting gears away from talking about husbands and wives and talking about relationships between parents and children. So just a quick recap of last week, Pastor Ryan introduced us to some of the differences between men and women. And in addition to that, he talked about some big subject material in the topic of submission. So wives, the big take home for you when it came to submission was that submission is an active choice to believe in and support your husband, to get behind your husband. And in doing that, you're making moves that in essence can have a positive impact on your family. And then he shifted gears and he talked about husbands and basically said, husbands, your responsibility as it pertains to taking care of your wife and your family is that you have to be willing to go the distance. And that distance means being willing to put yourself last, put others first, and ultimately caring for and loving the church in the same manner in which Jesus cares for and loves the church. And we know what Jesus did for the church. Jesus put his life on the line so that there could be such thing as the church. So that is a tall order for both men and women. And now we're going to shift gears and we're going to talk about the tall order of parenting that everyone is winning, right? Like all my parents out there, you're winning on a day-to-day basis. You feel fulfilled. You feel like you are on top of the world and there is nothing holding you back, all right? Okay, so we're good. All right, let's go to the picnic now and we'll eat and be merry and hug our kids a lot. All right, anyways, since that's not really the case, and I know this because of the week that I've had, we're going to dig into this topic of relationships between parents and children. And when I say children, I'm talking about these little people that are our children. They rely on us for a whole lot of everything. And I'm also referring to our relationship as adult children with our parents as well. So I'm going to take you behind the scenes in my life. This week, I had the pleasure of attending a couple of graduate courses that had me locked up during the day, Monday through Friday, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., and then again at night from 5:30 to 8:30. So what that effectively meant was I was not home a whole lot. And when I was home, I was either trying to eat something or read something or a little bit of both. And so I'm up late, I'm in class all day, and I'm not really connecting with any of these people that I say that I love and that I say that I'm willing to do anything for. And by the end of the week, by Friday, I literally felt estranged from the people that I'm the most intimate with, namely my wife and my kids. I missed them, they missed me, and so because they missed me so much, and I'm talking about these five little girls of mine, they told me a few things about myself, okay? And I don't know if that's ever happened to you, or if you've ever taken advice from a toddler, or a five-year-old, or a six-year-old. They don't really ask you if you want the advice, they just kind of freely dole it out in the hopes that it's going to be helpful. And so here's what I heard when I finally sat down on my couch. I heard, and this, I mean, I'm kind of laughing, but it's really not that funny. I heard, you love your work, or you care about your work more than you care about us. That was one of the things I heard. All right, that's a hard pill to swallow, right? And I'm thinking, no, you are wrong. I am paving the way for the future. I am making moves that are going to, like, put this family in an advantageous position. These are the things that I'm kind of mulling over in my head, which I realize if I would have said them out loud, they would have been very damaging to the little people that are looking me in the face, basically saying, Dad, we really miss you and we just want to connect with you. But as you can imagine, I felt extremely encouraged, right? I'm like, yes, these people are really encouraging me right now. They decided to take it one step further, and they started adding little adjectives to my work, and they were like, you're stinking work, all right? So, like, I am totally validated at this point in time. I've got the wrong job, I'm making the wrong moves, and I'm not spending time with the right people. God bless my children. And I love them to death. But here's what I noticed about that whole exchange or that whole encounter. A couple of things I picked up on. The first of which was my kids were not blatantly saying, Dad, you don't love us. What they were saying is, Dad, it appears as if you love certain things more than you love us. So they know that I love them, but based on the way that I was spending my time, they're asking questions like, well, he says he loves us, but he spends a lot of time doing thing A, so when we do the math, it seems like he loves that thing more than he loves us. That was one of the things that I picked up on. This other piece that I picked up on, which I think is very positive, and I've known this, but I knew this on a whole nother level this week, is I married, like, way up. And because my wife took care of me. She took care of my kids. At the end of the week, nobody was hurt. Everybody was alive. And everybody appeared to be sane, other than the fact that I was the brunt of their ridicule. But my wife, to me, she is the gold standard of what it means to put others first, and I've learned a ton about watching her operate in the context of our family. And so that was a big deal for me. But the big, big boat rocker, I mentioned this before, was the fact that I have five little people that are basically saying, Dad, it appears as if you believe one thing, but the way that you live doesn't really give us evidence of that. Now, granted, I'm home a lot. I mean, we're just coming off of a road trip where that's more than home. I mean, I'm taken hostage in a minivan at that point in time. I am with these people a ton. So I'm not saying that I'm missing the mark collectively, but and I'm not even saying that they're accurate in the assessment that they're making, but I am saying it's worth thinking about from my perspective as a parent. And so let me just simplify my thought process for you. What I'm really getting at is, as a parent, and I think we can apply this to us as human beings, there are certain things that we assert, certain things that we believe, but when the rubber of life hits the road, there is little evidence that indicates that we actually believe what we say we believe. And what I'm getting at there is, our actions are going to preach a message to people that's far more profound than anything we ever say. What we do is going to cast or broadcast our beliefs onto the people that are in our audience. And so, as a parent, what I'm confessing to you all is there are times when I struggle to align what I believe with what I actually practice in the context of my home as I attempt to relate to my children. Because my words are a dime a dozen. I mean, I can easily rattle off the I love yous, the I care about yous, the I'd do anything for you. But when I am absent, like those words mean absolutely nothing. And so I started asking myself some other questions. And the first one was, do my beliefs, are they rendered tangibly in my home? Are the things that I believe about how I'm supposed to take care of my kids, is there evidence of that? Or, and what I'm getting at here is, I want my kids to know that my love and affection for them is not something that they have to actively pursue or try to earn. It's something that they get. It's something that they have access to because they're my kids. I love them just because they're my kids. It's not based on anything they're going to do or not do. And so I asked the question, do my kids feel like they have to earn my affection, or is it something that they have open access to? And I'm not giving you any answers. I'm just saying these are the questions I ask myself. And basically, at the end of the day, I'm trying to come up with a response to the question, is my approach to parenting, the way that I interact with my family, is it centered on the gospel and the fact that I can't earn my keep with God and the fact that he's not going to ask me to earn my keep with him? Or is it centered on some criteria that I've formed that basically sets up a bunch of hoops that people have to jump through to feel loved and accepted? So before I go any further, I'm just going to throw this out there. And this This is me being honest with you. This is my biggest fear as a parent. And maybe this resonates, maybe it doesn't, but I'm going to share it anyway. My biggest fear as a parent is not, it's not found in what I'm going to explicitly teach my kids about God, because I can do that all day long. I mean, we can talk theology all day long. I can tell my kids about the grace of God and the love of God and the compassion of God and the whole nine yards, and we spend a lot of time doing that. My biggest fear is not my ability to tell my kids about God. My biggest fear is it really hinges on the lessons that I'm going to implicitly teach my kids about God, who He is, and how they're supposed to interact with Him based on my actions. That's my biggest fear. And I was kind of coming to grips with a week during which maybe I fell short, maybe I didn't. I think it's all a matter of perspective. But I think those questions are worth asking ourselves. Because in parenting, it's not just a tall order, it's God. The God of the universe, He's giving you access to influencing history. And that's an influence that's going to carry beyond the number of years that you live. It's going to carry beyond you, and it's going to impact people that you're never going to meet. It's going to impact people that you're never going to see. And so parenting, we've got to get a big vision for parenting. And part of that vision, I think it has to have some core values. And some of my core values, I'll just share them with you. So I'm convinced that one of my primary roles as it pertains to me and my kids is unconditional love. I'm called to love them unconditionally. This means no matter what. It means like good season, bad season, everything in between. There is nothing that's going to cause me to stop loving them. And as time goes by, I'm coming to the realization that, like, I don't care what you people end up doing or not doing, I am not going anywhere. I will be there. You're not going to get rid of me, kind of thing. The other thing that I think that I am called to do as a father, as a parent, is help my kids come to the realization that they're only going to find their ultimate meaning and purpose in the resurrected Jesus, in the person and work of Jesus. And that my relationship with them should put those things on display. It should make God's grace tangible. It should make God's grace tangible to the degree that they feel like they're having an interaction with it. It's something that they can touch. It's something that they can feel. It's something that they can draw from. And I think that those are some of my roles some of the lessons or roles that I have as a father. And so this morning, it's not my prerogative or my intent to say, hey, here's a prescription for parenting, and here's four bullet points that you should take home and nail them to your wall, tattoo them on your eyelids, whatever you got to do to make them happen. I'm not up here to offer prescriptions. I just want to cast a vision. I want to cast a vision about parent-child relationships. And before I dig into that any further, I just want to pause and say these are very personal, very sensitive issues. There are some folks, perhaps in this room, that when you bring up the idea of their mom or dad, it's just not a pleasant thought. It doesn't conjure up pleasant thoughts. Maybe there's a tattered past, or there's a background. There's something you're wrestling with, a trauma that you experience at the hands of your parents. So I want to acknowledge that. And then when it comes to kids, I mean, some of us, we had a brilliant vision for our kids. And somewhere along the way, we lost sight of it. They lost sight of it. The wheels fell off of the proverbial wagon. And things aren't as we wanted them to be. And that's difficult. It's difficult to reconcile that. And I want to acknowledge that those are very, like, our relationship with our parents and our relationships with our kids are very sensitive grounds. They're very sensitive topics to talk about. So I'm not up here to give you prescriptions. I really want to just give you a better understanding as to how God relates with us, how He loves us, how He parents us, how He takes care of us, and that in and of itself should transform the way that we engage in parent-child relationships, the way that we interact with our parents as adults, and the way that we interact with our children as we raise them. And so we're in Colossians chapter 3, and we're going to take a look at two verses, 20 and 21. And there we read, "Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Fathers, do not exasperate your children, so they won't become discouraged." And I think immediately we'll go to verse 20 and we're like, yeah, they have to obey us. All right, we wear that one out. Like we're, you know, like that's the quintessential meaning behind their existence is that they obey us as parents. So we're not going to start with that one. We're going to start with verse 21. And, you know, just a little bit of background on these two verses. They're very explicit. They give parents and children something to explicitly do. Children obey, parents don't exasperate your children. Those are action points, if you will. But in these, encompassed in these 22 words are some huge implications for the way that we parent. And the big idea that I really want to draw out as we embark this morning is that Jesus-centered parenting centered on the person and work of Jesus, the grace that is given to us freely in Jesus. Jesus-centered parenting, it brings grace to life in the context of our homes. At least it should. And so in verse 21, Paul is he's giving a charge to fathers, but we've got to take a look at verse 20 and say, hey, he's included moms in this as well, although he's highlighted fathers as a primary vehicle for this. And I think one of the reasons why is, you know, fathers have a unique role in the context of a family, and I think maybe he's getting at the fact that fathers have a proclivity for exasperating their children, maybe a little more than moms do. I don't know. I'm not going there. I'm just throwing that out there as food for thought. But he's telling us as parents that our relationship with our kids is a relationship of influence. It's a relationship that's going to do something to our kids. And that something may be positive or negative, but regardless of the positivity or the negativity of it, it's going to have an impact. We cannot get away from that. We can't pretend like we're not influencing our kids, even if it seems like we're not. And there are some pretty big things that happen out the gate for little people. And when I say little people, I'm talking about children. So if we look at that 0 to 5 context, so from age 0, that's a newborn, all the way up to age 5, and even a little after that, parents literally are the primary influence. And that is when a vast majority of brain development occurs, people acquire language, personalities are developed, and we are the drivers. We're one of the primary influences during that time. That is a big deal. That's a tall order. It's an awesome privilege and opportunity. And it's also daunting all at the same time. So what Paul is getting at is he's being honest with us, and he's saying, look, we can do this well or we can do this poorly. And he's saying, if you parent in a way that exasperates your children, not only is it going to be damaging to them as they're developing and relying heavily on you during those childhood years for absolutely everything, it's also going to have repercussions through adulthood. Paul wants us to have a broad vision when it comes to parenting. He doesn't want us to get caught in the moment, but he wants us to see what's on the horizon when it comes to parenting. And so in order to understand how I believe this works, we're going to take a look at two approaches or two paradigms to parenting that I feel these are like the, you know, if you want to make a child mad, do these things. And when I say make a child mad, let's just talk about that for a second. I have 5 daughters, right? And there are times where I am doing something that, like, there's no way it's going to make anybody mad, like giving you a cup of water. Okay, are you tracking with me? That shouldn't make people mad. You're thirsty. Here's your water. However, I've served it in the wrong cup. It doesn't have ice. And if it does have ice, I forgot to crush the ice. I'm like, who's working for who here? What is going on around here? There is something markedly wrong with these people that I love. And like, they're outwardly angry. Like, they're like, what are you doing? I can't. Like, please. Like, just let me give you a hug, you drink the water, and we'll move on. Oh, my goodness. Oh, man. So, I'm not talking about those instances where you didn't see it coming, necessarily, and you're actually doing something that has someone else's best interest in mind, like, I want to help quench your thirst. Yeah. Another one is... We recently took a road trip, and my kids are like, let's take the scenic route. And I don't do scenic routes. I like to go from point A to point B as fast as I can. Like, that is my speed. I don't want to stop. I don't want to eat anything. I just want to get there, because when I get there, we can do all that, right? And so I'm like, all right, I got to be flexible, I'm a parent. So they want to do the scenic route, and it is going swimmingly, right? They're like, this is the most beautiful thing we've ever seen. And I'm like, yeah, it's nice, but I'd really like to be there. We could have been there an hour ago. But I never say that out loud. And then we hit traffic. So we're staring at taillights. And they're like, why'd we take the scenic route? I'm like, hold up. Like, I got outvoted. I'm the only one in this vehicle that voted for the direct route. Throw me a bone. Come on. At any rate, we have the power to influence our children. And this paradigm that I'm going to present, it has an influence. And it's going to be a lasting one. And I am tagging it with a very broad label. And that label is legalistic. I'm calling it legalistic parenting. And it has some markers. And I'll just run through some of these markers so that you know what I'm talking about. Excessive severe discipline is one of the markers. Unreasonable harsh demands, abuse of authority, arbitrariness, unfairness, constant nagging, condemnation, humiliation, and insensitivity to a child's needs. The challenge with legalistic parenting is it puts you in a position where you are so concerned with rules, you miss the boat when it comes to relationship. You'd rather that your kid did thing A, B, and C than actually connect with your child. You look at things, programs that are more oriented towards behavioral modification than they are oriented towards deep heart change and deep connection with your children. And in essence, in a legalistic home, mistakes are not an option. So if you do make one and you're a child living in that context, I mean, of course you're going to tell your parents. Not. I mean, you like this creates deviousness and deceit in a child because they don't feel secure enough to actually come clean with anything. So if they're not coming clean with mistakes with mom and pop, I mean, good luck coming clean with anybody else, let alone coming clean with God when you make a mistake. In fact, it's not just a matter of not being able to make mistakes, but when you do, plan on being humiliated. Because legalistic parents are bent on rules at the expense of intimate relationship. And the thing with this approach to parenting, these folks tend to be pretty logical, and they're brilliant when it comes to coming up with a moral reason or rationale as to why they do the things that they do. They always have a good, you know, it's an answer that really hinges on morality, and it's a, you know, I treat my kids like that because, and they fill it in with some moral exercise that seems to make sense. But the problem with that is they're always right. So they're always speaking from a position of superiority. And what that means is they have a hard time relating with other people. And so they end up building a fence around their home and pointing the finger across that fence and telling their kids why everyone else is wrong and why everyone else doesn't meet up to their standards. And this creates a sense of fear in children. Especially when you're trying to, like we have this thing called the gospel that's supposed to transcend race, culture, sin, right? It's supposed to enter in and make us who we never would have been without it. But this presents a picture of the gospel that's quite interesting. Because these types of people are navigating life and they're freaked out about Hollywood. The gay community or transgender community has these folks terrified. They've pegged movies and music and all types of things, public schools, I mean, you name it, as something that's going to do something to my children. And they never thought about the idea of how the gospel is only capable of doing something to all those things. Like, the gospel is the catalyst for change. And so when we approach parenting like that, when we're terrified of the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus, what we're showing our kids is a picture of God that poses him as some like impotent grandfather that's really, he's getting really old and he doesn't really make sense anymore. And it used to be nice to sit on his knee and hear his stories, but that's over. You present a gospel that's one-dimensional. And really, that gospel is only accessible to people that are like you. It's accessible to people that are willing to work hard to attain God's love and acceptance. And the bottom line is that is not the gospel. It's not a gospel that I want to believe in. It's a gospel that exhausts people and leaves them weak. And when it comes to children, ultimately what it does is it says, it causes them to draw the conclusion that my mom and dad, they only love me when. And you fill in the blank with some form of success. And my mom and dad, they validate me when. And you fill in the blank with some form of success. The problem is the successes are few and far between. Because the legalistic parent has never really taken the time to draw out what the child's actually good at. Or what they're made to do or made to excel in. And I like to illustrate this a little bit. And I, myself, like to think of myself as a non-legalist when it comes to parenting. But I'm just going to tell you about, like, the natural order of things in my household. Because we all assign value to things, and it's arbitrary. We'll say, like, and by way of our actions or the decisions we make, we say, these things are valuable, these things are not. And so I'm going to talk about my two oldest daughters. The oldest is 8. She's athletic. From the time that she was, I don't even know. We were just like, hey, we concluded she's athletic. She likes to climb. She likes to run. She likes to jump. By the time she was 4, she figured out how to climb one of the trees in our yard so that she could do pull-ups. I'm like, what? Like, you're just making me tired. What do you think? Stop. I feel inadequate. But this is what she would do, and she'd do that, like, as long as you'd let her. And no one even had to say, hey, oldest child, why don't you go do that? It was just something that she did. And, as time went by, we realized, hey, this isn't just a seasonal thing. She actually has an interest in something called gymnastics. And when she first heard about gymnastics, she was like, Dad, I'm a gymnastiker. And we were like, cool. You're also a linguist because you're making up new words, but whatever. So we ended up enrolling her in a gymnastics class. And as we should, we were happy about that, right? We're happy about that. We clap for her. We applaud her. We assign value to gymnastics. You tracking with me? We're saying gymnastics is positive, and we like it when you do gymnastics. Now, here's where the boat starts to rock. We have 5 kids, okay? Not all of them are made for gymnastics. So when I'm clapping for the gymnastiker, the non-gymnastickers are like, he doesn't even care about us. He clearly doesn't love us, right? So then you're like, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to be neutral about everything? No, I don't think so. I think God is calling us to elicit from our children what they're made to do and help them pursue that. Within reason. All right, so, yeah, so, I mean, you can take that wherever you want to take it. There are some things your children should not be doing, and they're highly interested in. At any rate, so we have child number 2, and I'm not using names because I don't want you to judge any of my children. But child number 2 is 6 right now. And this kid, from the time that she was young, just very intuitive, very brilliant, large vocabulary, had an interest in books. I mean, she was like not even 1, and she'd sit up in her crib for hours at a time just flipping the pages in books. And we were like, okay, that's kind of cool. She's occupied. She's quiet. She likes books. Well, when she learned how to read, which nobody really figured out when she learned how to read because she was not very honest about it. I mean, it was to the point where her kindergarten teacher was like, your child's never going to learn how to read, Mr. Mayhew. And then like 2 months later, she was like, we've never seen such progress in reading, Mr. Mayhew. And we were like, she duped you. But she will read volumes and volumes and volumes of books. We do this little summer reading program at home, and the first day, she read like 5 or 6 books. And we're like, yeah, reader, reader in the house, clapping for the reader now. Everybody clap for the reader. And the gymnastiker is like, nobody loves me anymore. I guess I'll quit gymnastics and start reading. And she actually came to me and she said, Dad, you know what? And she's 8, so she's thinking through things a little more abstractly now. She was like, Dad, I think I'm going to start reading a lot of books. And I'm like, no, you're not. Just climb higher on the tree. And just to clarify, she does read. She does read. It's not that she's not a reader. She just doesn't read at that pace. And it's fine. And it's good. And the point that I'm trying to make here is we're assigning value in either context. We've basically said, by way of our actions and our response, we value reading and we value gymnastics. Now, there are a world of possibilities. I got three others that I haven't even mentioned who don't do either. And so you can only imagine what it's like for them at this point in time. So this is a tall order. Good luck figuring it out. Let me know when you do, because I'd love to hear about it. But let's go back to this idea of legalism. Legalists assign value to things too, and it's the punch list, the checklist, the to-do list, the behavior modification list, the things that you're supposed to be focused on list, and sometimes, which is a lot of times, or all the time, those lists are at odds with building intimate, loving relationships with children. They're at odds with imparting this idea of unconditional love and grace that we see in the way that God loves us. So that's one style of parenting. And, you know, just to tie this back to the text, that method is always going to exasperate a human being because they're never going to feel loved and they're never going to feel accepted. They're going to feel isolated and alone and abandoned. And that's what Paul's talking about. He's saying, don't leave your children hopeless. Don't let it be that when they think of the God of the universe, they feel hopeless and inadequate. Paul is saying, when your children think of the God of the universe, they should think of being loved and accepted unconditionally. So there's another paradigm that we can look at when it comes to parenting. And these people are not legalists. These are like the free-range parents. They're the parents that, instead of making their children earn their affection, which is what the legalist in effect is doing, they're scared about losing their child's affection. And so they pander and they bend to the every wish, the every beck and call of their children. They have a real hard time saying no. And I tell you what, a tantrum is convincing every single time. And in the back of their mind, they're thinking, I want to be my child's friend forever. We want to be best friends forever. They're like, hashtag BFF, me and my kid. And it's a great thought. I want to be friends with my kids too, but I also want them to be prepared for a reality that is not going to pander to them. A boss that's going to say, okay, cool, you don't want to do that? Then you don't want to work here. I want them to be prepared for a reality that's not going to meet them the way that I'm meeting them if I give way to their every wish, their every demand, their every desire. If I indulge my children, I'm not preparing them for a reality in which they're eventually going to live. And hopefully independently. And that will wreak havoc on them, because when they see that the world functions differently than the way life is inside of their home, again, that's exasperation. That's anger. That's my mom and dad didn't prepare me for life. I'm bitter towards them. I don't want to be around them. And that maybe results in some deep wounds and some broken relationship. And I would wager that it does. And ultimately, the parent who indulges the child is projecting a God who literally is, like, he doesn't do anything other than what we tell him to. He's a God who's kind of on standby. He's like a concierge, and you call him, and you're like, yeah, we need prime rib, or we need whatever, or how do you get to there? He's a God that serves our needs. He's a God that serves our demands. He's not the God of the Bible. He's a God that essentially leaves that child feeling hopeless. And again, that is what Paul is talking about when he uses the word exasperate. Don't leave your children feeling hopeless. So ultimately, both of these parenting styles, whether lackadaisical or legalistic, if we want to call them that, they result in frustration and anger. And that carries through, it can carry through adulthood and beyond. And so we're going to take a look at what I believe is something we can extract from the Colossian text. And before we do that, we're going to take a peek at Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4, because Paul essentially is saying the same thing to the Ephesians that he said to the Colossians, only there's a little addendum at the end where he's adding something. He's kind of adding the scope of parenting. And he says in Ephesians 6, verse 4, fathers, don't stir up anger in your children, but bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. So again, this is the same thing he's already said to the Colossian believers, but he's giving you something to aim at. And that something he's giving you to aim at is the instruction, right? It's the training and instruction of Jesus. It's parenting that has to be centered on who Jesus is and what Jesus said and what Jesus does to make us right before God. It's a parenting that has to be centered on unconditional love, because that's the only kind of love Jesus is capable of delivering. Jesus does not deliver a love upon condition. He freely delivers it based on his own merit, based on his own worth, based on his own accomplishment. So that's outside of us. We can't earn that. And there's a way for us to attune ourselves to the grace that we receive freely from Jesus as we parent our children. And this is going to allow us to do some things. Ultimately, when we're centered on the person and work of Jesus as we navigate life with these little people that are complaining about crushed ice or whole cube or whatever they're complaining about, it's going to give us the opportunity to see through all of that. See through all the times that they've disobeyed or didn't live up to our standard. And it's going to allow us to look at them and say, you know what? I love you for you. Like, I love you just because you're you. Like, God put you into my family, and that's why I love you. And I can't even always explain it, because sometimes I personally am frustrated. But I know at the end of the day, I love you just because you're you. There's nothing more to it. There's nothing less to it. It has nothing to do with anything that they're going to accomplish or not accomplish. Now, this approach, it requires some things. And one of those things is discipline. And it's not discipline for the sake of discipline. It's not discipline as a result of a child not living up to your standards. It's discipline that at the end of the day communicates that you are willing to do whatever it takes to win them back. You're willing to go whatever length you have to go to make sure that they know that they're only going to find ultimate unconditional love in the person and work of Jesus. And the love of God that comes to us freely through Jesus. It's us saying, no matter what, no matter how hard, no matter how trying, no matter how difficult or how confused I feel, I am going to do anything for you. And ultimately, we want them to know that there is a God who loves them more than we ever will, more than we're even capable of. And so, I'm convinced that when we approach children with grace, we're really setting them up for success in so many ways. And we're going to go back to verse 20, because I think one of the ways we're setting them up for success is with regards to verse 20, where Paul is aiming at children. He validates them as members of the church, in a sense, and he says to them, children, obey your parents. And that's mom and dad. That's not just pick a parent to obey and then really consult with the other one about what you're really supposed to do. That's obey both of your parents. That's father, that's mother. And one of the things that grace does as children attempt to obey us is it changes their perspective on obedience. At least it has the power to. And it's going to allow them to approach obedience not as a thing that they're supposed to do, but as a response to the way that they feel loved and accepted. They're going to approach us differently because we're approaching them differently. Now, we could easily apply this to like little children and stop there, but we're not going to do that because most of us are adults in this room. So we're going to take it a little step further, and we're going to go out on a limb, and this really isn't us going out on a limb, because the Bible, what it does is it talks about human development in a sense, and during human development, our relationship with our parents changes. When we're little children, like I need mom and dad, I need mom and pop to provide everything for me. I need to ride in their car, I need to eat their food, I need to sleep under their roof. I need their financial support. I need their wisdom. I need them. There's an intrinsic need for them because of physical limitations. I just can't provide for myself at that point in time. But as I get older, that thing called obedience as the target for us as children translates to something called honor. And as an adult, I'm sorry, and my mom's right over there, so I don't feel bad saying this. I am not here to obey my mom at this point in time. I love her and I honor her, but like if I started trying to obey my mom, that woman that's in the other room, I'm sorry, she's coming at me something fierce. No thanks. And the Bible specifically says at a certain point in time, like leave your home. Like get out of the basement. Go do something with your life. Marry up. Or just get a job. I mean, that'd be cool. But Paul, what he's ultimately saying here is, in honoring your parents, in obeying your parents, it's not for the sake of honor or the sake of obedience. What you are effectively doing is honoring God, right? And we're going to talk a little bit about what that means. But before we do so, I want to show you that the fifth commandment, which is aimed at adult children, here's what it says. It says, honor your father and your mother so that you may have a long life in the land that the Lord God has given you. So we're going to make some distinctions here, right? And some of those distinctions are very, very important when it comes to honor. Honor does not mean showing inordinate amounts of affection to your parents. It doesn't mean pretending like they did everything right. It doesn't mean like lifting them up on a pedestal and saying, they're the greatest thing that has ever happened to the world of children. Honoring your parents does not, and it should not, force you to believe things about your parents that aren't true. What it should do is cause you to recognize your parents as people who have human dignity because God made them. It should allow you to interpret their behavior, the things that they did, and separate right from wrong. It should allow you to give applause where applause is due, and it should allow you to refrain that applause when you really should. Because the reality is, when you start thinking about your parents, something comes to mind. And for some of us, that something is tragedy. That something is abandonment, it's abuse. You feel like they left you out on your own too soon. When you needed them the most, they weren't there. You know, that when you needed a kind word or a loving embrace, you got harsh words and you caught the end of their wrath. That's the reality for some of us. And so for others, like, our parents are very admirable. So cool. Admire them. Applaud them. Like, clap for them. Tell them they did a great job. I think that's fine. But don't pretend like your parents are somebody that they're not. Come to grips with what that experience was like. That's what honoring your parents means. And so as adults, we're called and we're allowed to honor our parents apart from admiration, apart from obedience, apart from trust, because some of our parents weren't very trustworthy. And it's okay. We're called to honor our parents outside of forced feelings and forced opinions about them. And we do this because ultimately it brings honor to God. That's the real driving motivation here, is when I honor my parents, in a sense, some way, somehow, I am honoring God. And so let's talk about some practical ways we can honor our parents. One way is this: pick up the phone and call them. Ask them a question about what you should do with whatever it is that you're doing. And then don't take their advice, because you don't have to. I'm just giving you some freedom here, people. You are free to call your mom and dad today and be like, hey, should I buy the house? And when they say yes, you hang up and you're like, I'm never buying that house. That's okay. You're building a relationship, right? Another thing you can do, pick up the phone and be like, hey, dad. And I like to try to do this with my dad who's here. And I never really know how he interprets it, because he's hard as nails, in my opinion, in some regards. But I love him to death, and he's got a soft heart, and he taught me a ton. But I like to call him up and on a whim be like, hey, thanks for teaching me how to work. Thanks for showing me what it means to show up early and stay late. Thanks for showing me what it means to take care of a family. Did he do everything right? Absolutely not. But he needs to hear, because who else is going to validate him as a parent? There's nobody else out there that's going to be like, hey, Mr. Mayhew, you really killed it in the parenting department. I never was there for any of it. Like, I am the case study for my dad and his parenting experience. So it makes sense, me having been a part of the project that it was, to be like, hey, this is where we really nailed it. This is where we fell short. And I'm really saying, in honoring our parents, we're emphasizing the things that we learned from them that have been helpful to us. All right, those are ways we can honor our parents. Another way, just give them a place at the table. Like, if there's a head at the table, put them there. Who cares if they deserve it? Just put them there. It's a way for you to honor them. And I'm saying all this very candidly and with humor, but I want to say this as well before I go further. These things that I'm talking about aren't for everybody. So Don't take it as the letter of the law. You know, maybe you're at a place where it's not wise of you to call your parents. It's not wise of you to try to rekindle a connection. Don't. I'm not telling you to do that. But the next thing I'm going to tell you is, it is the quintessential way to honor your parents, and that is forgive them. Interpret what they did through the lens of the gospel and free them from all the pain, all the heartache. Free them from the things that they did that were just wrong. Call them wrong. It's okay. And so forgiveness is the move you can make as an adult child, as an adult who has a relationship with another adult who happens to be your parent. Extend forgiveness. And this applies to everyone. And here's what's going to happen if you decide not to do this. You're going to be embittered, and it's going to last a long time. You're going to be angry at them, and it's going to last a long time. And the reality is, in forgiving them, you think of it like this. You're really doing it more for you than you are for them. Because if you're embittered at your parents, guess what? They're driving the way that you behave. And here's what it translates to. I never got approval and love from my mom or dad, so I'm working really hard in my career, and I'm going to become really, really successful, and then I'm going to tell them about it, and they're finally going to approve of me and finally going to accept me. The challenge is they may never accept you. They may not even know how. And so you are going to be driven until you forgive them by a desire to be loved and approved by them. And I'm not saying that's wrong. You should want to be loved and approved by your parents. I know I do. But ultimately, what Paul is telling us when he talks about the gospel, what Jesus came to show us, is that people, the people that we seek approval from, the people that we love the most, that we want to affirm us, they cannot love us the way that only Jesus can love us. They can't love us without condition. Only Jesus can do that. Only God can do that. So if our parents, if your parents, if my parents have done anything to maim me or hurt me or scar me, the way that I can honor them, despite all that, is simply by extending forgiveness to them. And in that, I'm going to be freed from constantly groping to grasp their verdict, to hear the words from my mother and father, well done, good servant. And so here's ultimately what we're talking about. We're talking about people who physically have reached the age of adulthood, but psychologically are still that 10-year-old girl or boy that's saying, all I want is my mom to validate me. All I want is my dad to put his arm around me and tell me that he cares about me. And Paul's saying there's a remedy for that. There's a remedy that will allow you to grow up psychologically, spiritually, and to experience the love and the validation that you've always wanted and you've never really experienced. Because even if your parents knocked it out of the park in the parenting department, I'm sorry, they're not perfect. There's something missing. There's something flawed in their approach. There's going to be something flawed in my approach to my kids. And so I have to teach them to look outside of me, outside of themselves, and into the eyes of a Jesus who's saying, guess what? My love for you and my validation of you for you, it's not based on you. I love you for you, because only Jesus is capable of loving us for who we are. And when I reflect on my experience as a child and as a parent and now as an adult that's trying to relate to adult children, I'm sorry. There are so many mistakes along the way that come to mind that I feel like I'm not winning, that I failed. And then when I zoom in on my, you know, me as a parent, I'm sorry. I'm up at night. I don't know about any of you that are parenting kids. I'm up at night wondering, am I doing this right? Am I really connecting with them? Can I really provide for them? Are they going to be prepared to make decisions consistent with the decisions that God would have them make? Am I effectively parenting them to know the God that's going to take care of them in ways that I cannot? And I'm just going to submit this to you, and then we'll start winding down here. I am not convinced that God looked through the corridor of time into the future and was like, you know what, that guy who lives in Severn at 1024 Reese Road, I'm calling him to parenthood because he is a rock star parent. I'm sorry, that's not why God called me to be a father. God called me, and I'm convinced of this, to be a dad so that I could learn something about God that otherwise I would have no idea about. God is revealing himself to me through the plight of parenthood. And if you're not a parent, God is going to use some other means, some other relationship to reveal himself to you in a deep, tangible way. And so as you're thinking about your success or your failure as a parent, know that your standing before God is not based on whether or not you're a successful mom or dad, or whether or not you've really reconciled with the parents that hurt you, or whether or not you've really forgiven and honored your parents. Because the bottom line is, we fell short when it came to honoring our mother and father. The fifth commandment, it stood in our way. We can't live up to it. And ultimately, God wants us as sons and daughters to feel a deep sense of security in his love and affection for us. Because here's how God parents us. God parents us always with grace. God treats us at every bend, at every turn, in every circumstance with grace. Grace is at the center of how God interacts with us. Grace is the means by which God has brought us back to himself. And if we look at chapter 15 in Luke's gospel account, there's a story that's relatively familiar to us church folk. And we're going to come face to face with what we like to call the prodigal son. And this prodigal son, he's an adult. He's disrespectful. He's rude. He's short-sighted. He's dishonoring. And he goes to his dad and he says, "Dad, I know you're not dead yet, but I really kind of wish that you were so I could capitalize on this bank account that you're sitting on in property." And he's like, "Dad, can I just get what I'm eventually going to have? Can I get my share of the inheritance?" And interestingly, the father says, "Okay." And he liquidates some of his assets. And he puts those financial resources in his son's hands. And his son starts navigating away from home and out into the world, where he's going to begin applying ideas about God, ideas about whatever he's learned in his home, ideas that he's adapted and come up with on his own. And basically, he's on a journey to find himself. He exhausts his resources, and he's left homeless, jobless, and flat broke. He lands a dead-end job taking care of animals. Not just any animals, but animals that were culturally just dirty and filthy. And he's not just taking care of them, he's living with them. He has absolutely hit the bottom of the proverbial barrel, and he concludes, "I'm going home." But he wasn't even ready to go home. He said, "I'm not going home because I want to be a son again." He didn't even have that in mind. He said, "I'm going home because I just want to be a son in the Father's house. I want to go back to where my dad is the primary caretaker of everything, because my dad knows what he's doing. And I just want to be a slave. I want to reap peripheral benefits of being around a father that loves me." And before he could even confess his desire to come home, the dad runs fast and furious to his son. And he embraces his son. And he says, "Son, I never stopped loving you, even while you were gone. Son, welcome home." He welcomes him home, and the reason why he's able to welcome him home, his love for his son is not contingent upon the rat race that his son was running, or the misappropriation of financial resources, or the way that he didn't meet the markers of cultural success. And in fact, he had completely shamed his father in the way that he had behaved. He did nothing that was even remotely in resemblance to honoring his dad. And his dad said, "Son, I never stopped loving you. I never stopped wanting you to be a part of who I am." And so that's a picture that I think we really need to hang our hat on. We need to hang our hope on. And the picture is this, that Jesus is the ultimate son who gave up the love of the ultimate Father. When he hung on that cross and he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus was forfeiting his right to a love that he had always known. And he did that so that you could experience the love that you've always wanted to know. Jesus forfeited his access to unconditional, undying, I'm never going to let you go love, so that you could experience the unconditional, undying love of the Father. Jesus gave something up so that you could have something that you've always wanted. Jesus showed us unconditional love, and he's freely given it to us so that now we can tap into that unconditional love and interact with it and experience it and take it to the center of our families and let it influence the way that we relate with our kids and let it influence the way that we relate with our parents as adults, the way that we forgive them, the way that we honor them, the way that we give them a place at the table. Jesus gave up love so that we could be loved. That's all I have for you this morning.